everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of LID Radio Podcast. I'm your host for today, Francesca Stainer, and for this episode we are talking to Neil Usher about his new book, Elemental Change, Making Stuff Happen When Nothing Stands Still. Now, Neil has almost 30 years' experience as a business leader who has delivered innovative working environments for large organisations globally. Together with his practical experience, regular conferences and academic talks, they've made him a leading thinker in the profession. So now about his book, Elemental Change. Our intensely interconnected world never stops evolving. Amid the chaos of intended and unintended consequences, we're expected to lead a change initiative. We have to learn fast as it's already started. In Elemental Change, a highly practical, human and entertaining book, we're guided in how we can make complex change attainable, whether we have years of experience or are facing our major first challenge. It helps us think about what change is and means, how we prepare for it, and what we do to make it successful. The Elemental framework is highly portable, making it relevant to any location, sector, culture, or discipline. Using the proven approach, methods, and tools in this book, crafted from 4 decades of making it happen, we'll be leading change naturally. So thank you so much for joining us, Neil. Let's start talking about the book, Elemental Change. Can you tell us a bit about why you wrote the book and what we can expect from it?
I think I've probably questioned my sanity on a few occasions, certainly during the sort of the early stages of writing it, and probably some of the later stages of writing. There's probably a good bit in the middle. But I think there were sort of 2 drivers, really. After the last book, Elemental Workplace, which I finished writing in 2017 and then went into the sort of editing process, I felt probably something wasn't finished. I wrote about change over the space of about 10 pages, and it seemed to resonate with quite a few people. Quick calculations suggested that was probably less than 5% of the book. And so I felt really that it needed more of an explanation. I didn't know exactly how much more of an explanation, whether it was a book's worth, but somehow something was telling me that I needed to sort of draw that out, because sort of second level, really, I'd always held that change is the sort of overriding discipline in just about everything we do, and that everything else we do is a subset of that. But we still seem to approach our professions in the sort of reverse mindset, effectively, which is that doing the change is somehow a sort of a downstream activity, and that we see our profession as the overriding activity in all of that. But so I think the 2 things together, really feeling like I needed to say something more about change, and also this belief really that we were all leaders of change, and what we do in professional terms is downstream, was something that needed to be addressed in at another level. So I think what you can expect is a practical guide. I've tried to make it accessible, readable, hopefully entertaining, and it talks to you like an adult. And I hope you feel really that I'm in it with you. I'm not kind of lecturing you or sort of telling you what to do from the hillside. I'm actually sort of, I'm sort of knee deep in it with you, and I'm guiding you through it. As I tried to do with the Elemental Workplace, hopefully it sort of draws everything that's out there really together in one place, so that if you really only need one book about leading change, then hopefully this might be it.
Yeah, and how relevant for the moment as well.
Entirely accidental, because I probably started it near on 2 years ago, or thinking about it 2 years ago. Obviously, I'd rather it was under better circumstances than this. But yes, change is very much in the forefront of many people's minds. Hopefully it's of its time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd love to start talking about some of the common myths about change that you debunk. I think they're really interesting, particularly that we hate change is one of them, and that change is happening faster now, which is something I've often heard and often seen in other books as well. So what are those? Why are those myths, and what have you debunked from them?
I guess I've always been a little frustrated with the sort of the notion that, we hate change, because when we look at it in terms of our own personal lives, we're always sort of casting hooks into the future. We're always looking at what we'd like to be different in our personal lives. We find some patterns that we'd like to keep fairly similar, but You know, if we look at the minutiae of our lives, it's all about change. And then we somehow, when we get into a professional environment, seem to take a different mindset or approach it differently. But I do argue that change is our very essence. We are sort of living, breathing change in that sense. And so to say we hate it is a bit of a nonsense, really. We might dislike some specific changes that are proposed or that are happening, but it doesn't mean we dislike the whole idea of it. And I think there's this really interesting evolutionary irony, because I came across a lot of books that say we're hardwired to resist change, that somehow we fight against it in some way. But if that was true, we wouldn't have got much further than the end of the Olduvai Gorge, and humanity would not have evolved in the way it has, and so all those books would never have been written. So really, there's I think we're telling ourselves a lot of the time that we hate change, but the actual reality of our lives is completely contrary to that. When we think about the pace of change, I think we see it in experience as being fast, because we have so many channels coming to us, explaining to us that things are moving, that things are different. And what we also forget is just how resourceful we've become in understanding and dealing with change. So in many ways, if the pace of change has increased, then so has the pace of us in dealing with it. And there are many arguments to suggest that potentially the pace of innovation has actually slowed in the last 100 years rather than accelerated. Okay. It's just that we see it and feel it more readily than perhaps we used to. If we think back sort of several hundred years, the actual sort of, the actual sort of media that were available for us to see and experience change were far more restricted. So that it was very possible that we sensed that actually not a lot was going on, but it was still going on to the same proportional degree that it is today.
I find it fascinating. Every time I read about change, it's kind of like, it's almost as if you wake up one morning and suddenly change begins. And it always makes it sound like it suddenly turns on and suddenly turns off. But like every day, something's changing, like something will be developing, something will be evolving. It might just be small and you don't notice it. But whenever you read about it, it's kind of like, one day suddenly everything will change. And that's why we resist it, because it's so big. But I don't know. I think there are so many small changes that we live through every day, but maybe we just aren't as attuned to them because they're so small.
So some of the small changes are actually the changes we're driving as well. What we're doing impacts, those around us. What those around us are doing impacts us. And so that dynamic is in constant play.
Yeah.
And so it's not something that has a definitive start and end point. We just in our lives, we tap into that continuum in a way that is constantly evolving. And then at some point in time, we sort of tap out of it again. But yes, that change is continual, and there's nothing we can necessarily do about that. But we sometimes we see change as being something we're sort of conscious of because it resonates or strikes a chord with us. But we're often not actually directly conscious of a lot of the changes that are happening and a lot of the changes that we're making happen.
Yeah, true. And imagine how boring life would be if nothing changed.
Absolutely. And I talk about certainty and uncertainty. And if we think about organisational life, and we think about sort of the way organisations work, they are constantly craving certainty. But if everything is incredibly certain, then nothing interesting ever happens. So actually, uncertainty is our opportunity. And whilst we have to manage risk in that, because with every opportunity comes a sort of equal and opposite risk that needs to be managed, it's uncertainty that enables us to make progress both professionally and organizationally. So uncertainty is a good thing. It's something we should crave. It's something we should actually seek to create, because that's where the routes and the avenues to change occur. If everything is completely certain, then when we wake up every morning and we know exactly what's going to happen and that everyone's going to do everything we expect them to do, then we're sort of creating a situation really where we will make absolutely no progress at all.
So the book split into these three sections on the whole. The first section is working out why. So why change and why now? What are some of the common reasons companies should consider change? Are there ever any situations where change is kind of suggested but actually not necessary?
I think that part of the sort of difficulty we encounter in organizational life is there's a huge amount of noise. Everybody is encouraged to be doing something. They're measured on doing something. You know, they have to create outputs, they have to create something visible. So we do have this environment with this sort of, you know, this constant hum, if you like, of people doing stuff and measuring stuff and trying to show sort of what they've done. So I think that change is ongoing. That change is a day-to-day feature of organizational life. Whether it's important, significant, or its impact is felt is another thing. What I'm sort of really arguing in this section is that sort of having that fundamental understanding of change is incredibly important. Having that infrastructure, as I call it, of change, where you understand what it is, what it means, how it works, how it operates, the environment we're in, from the sort of the universal ideas through to those that sort of I characterize as more global ideas, and then to those that are very localized in relation to ourselves and our organizations. A lot of sort of change material that you'll find doesn't really delve into that kind of, you know, basic foundation of understanding of change before it starts getting into what we should do and how we should do it. So I've tried to really get into the, you know, in an accessible and a digestible way. I've tried to give a framework to explain why change is, you know, why these opportunities exist, why uncertainty is a good thing. But also some of the pitfalls and some of the things we'll encounter along the way, because, you know, as the subtitle suggests, you know, we're trying to get things done in a world where nothing stands still. So how do we get things done in a world where nothing stands still? Well, it's actually about sort of seeking those opportunities in that fluid and dynamic form that, you know, that really is where beneficial change happens.
Yeah, and speaking of kind of the pitfalls, I know we've all probably been in one of those companies where we're announcing a change, maybe, you know, new values or something, the way we process things is different. There's often resistance from maybe a few employees, certain people, or even stakeholders, clients. How do you deal with kind of change resistance from people when you're in companies? And is it quite common? I can imagine it probably is.
I think a lot of things that are a process of seeking to understand, inquiry, you know, potentially sort of, you know, trying to get deeper into what's proposed are often characterized as resistance. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, change initiatives are, you know, they almost set themselves up to expect resistance and start using the language of resistance, which sort of further exacerbates the problem. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of the time, there's fantastic insight to be gained from those people who might initially be deemed to be resistors. You know, they've usually got a really valid contribution to make, and we have to sort of dig into that and find out what's going on. Because the easiest people in any change initiative to convince that it's a good idea are the people who thought of the idea in the first place. So, you know, it's really important to start understanding as we communicate and as we engage and as we get people involved. It's really important to start understanding how people feel, what it means to them individually, what it means to them as groups and teams. You know, because it's quite likely that we've got something wrong, or that we've misunderstood something, or mistimed something. And so what we're really all about is what we perceive to be insight is looking, what we perceive to be resistance is looking for the insight in that.
That's so true. And actually, probably something that someone brings up that, as you said, is deemed as resistant is probably something that maybe someone from the outside, external clients or customers, it's probably going to think as well.
Well, we're also fixated on sort of transactional methods as well. So things like buy-in. I mean, I don't address it initially as a myth, but something that I look at a little later is the sense that somehow we're trying to move everybody into a particular column in our balance sheet almost, you know, those that sort of move everybody from sort of being a resistor to being a supporter of the initiative. But you know, taking this transactional approach is actually not likely to be particularly helpful in understanding and how people are feeling and gaining that insight. So what we actually want are sort of critical participants in all of this. And people may move to the sort of, you know, resistance and support camps on a regular basis, depending on what's happening over a period of time. You know, this idea that, you know, everybody is bought in is not a final position that people take. What we actually want are people looking at what we're doing, open channels of communication with people, hearing them, understanding what they're feeling, what they're seeing, and understanding their emotional position and bringing them with us in that way. So sometimes we're our own worst enemies by sort of teeing everything up in a transactional sense.
Yeah, having someone with a critical eye along the side, yeah. I mean, moving on to kind of the second part of the book, it's the how. So we've done the why, now how. And you use the phrase, change is messy, but so is life, which I love. And this is why change kind of needs the preparation phase. I mean, there are many examples of how to put change into action and what to consider. One that was really interesting to me was opportunity mapping and working out sort of the risk versus the opportunity. Can you explain a bit more about what this is?
Sure, this is sort of part of what I've called the change operating system. So, everything we use these days has an operating system. It sort of connects the applications we run with the box of wires, effectively, which would be, completely useless without an operating system. And I think with change being, continual and very often uncertain, I think, a preparation is more important than planning a lot of the time. Plans can be very soft and can be very flexible and fluid, but actually what is just as important, if not more important, is this idea that we're prepared for change. And there are six components of that operating system, one of which is opportunity, which I think is broader and is more encompassing than when we start looking at the vision itself, where we start to condense a lot of that thinking into something which we can then hang everything else off. So opportunity assessment and opportunity planning, and then leading into creating a map of that opportunity. It helps us then manage the associated risks. So we use a very similar technique for mapping opportunity to mapping risk. But in most organizations, all we ever see is the risk planning, because organizations are fundamentally set up to stop people doing things. They're set up to stop people taking initiative and generally to stop people spending money. If you look at the way that organizations operate, very often it's human spirit and human motivation that gets us beyond these constraints and these restrictions. So actually having taking the time to actually map that opportunity, which will then create sort of sub opportunities within that, gives us the ideal landscape then in terms of sort of bringing all of the other components of the operating system in. I do see it very much as the starting point. And the vision itself is then derived from that opportunity mapping process. But I've not seen that undertaken in organizations before. And I have to say, in just about all the change projects that I've ever led, I've never really spent the time going through that opportunity mapping. So it was probably quite a useful process to go through personally in putting it together for the book.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wonder why it's always risk over opportunity. I mean, I'm sure ultimately down to consigner kind of financials and losing money, but also actually opportunity. Surely that's what you need to be going after as well. Like, that's what makes it successful.
Governance has become, increasingly important in organizations over the last few decades, and there are understandable reasons for that. Mm. But we do tend to focus on the very small percentage chances of things happening, very often in terms of resource thinking, planning, making sure that there are, there is no way that something potentially serious could happen. Forgetting sometimes that the structures and everything we create to ensure those things don't happen actually then prevent the really interesting things from happening at the same time. But lots of interesting things do happen and lots of amazing change initiatives do run. So people are finding ways through that and around that. And that is not a sort of blanket reason that nothing happens. But there are ways hopefully in sort of just about every organization, those opportunities can be identified and can then be used to galvanize participation and resources necessary to actually drive that change.
Yeah, I think especially now with everything that's happening with in terms of COVID, companies have been so much more innovative. So some of my local shops and things are running such interesting campaigns that I don't think they ever would have if this hadn't have happened.
And the adversity has brought out, as you say, some fascinating examples. I think what I sensed really with the recession that we experienced last time, a lot of people compare what's happening now to what happened during the recession. Yeah. Was that during the recession, there was a sense that we just have to sort of ride something out and everything will return to the way it used to be. If we can just manage to sort of, buckle up and survive this and get through this, eventually the world economy will return to the way it used to be and we'll have got over this debt crisis and put a few new rules in place and move on. But I think there's a sense now that, you know, this is the like of which we've never seen before. And so so organizations, you know, have no real kind of, you know, future line to aim for in terms of, oh yeah, it's all going to be over by mid 2021, or it's all going to be over by the end of the year. You know, and so therefore are having to innovate and having to make those changes on the basis of the fact that that could become their new business model. That could become their new, the way they operate entirely. And they may never go back to the way they used to operate. So very different, really, I think, in terms of that future uncertainty from the recession. And I think that's driving a lot more of that innovation and a lot more of that sort of, you know, really, really fantastically creative thinking in terms of how can we take the way we used to work into a new model of how we might work in the future. And that might just be preferable to the way we used to work. And as you say, we might never have thought of that had this crisis not arisen.
Yeah, the new normal.
Yeah, that, and actually this sort of notion of a normal, I mean, it can be quite easily argued, I think, that what we regarded as a normal was something of a historical accident as well. Because a normal almost implies that the evolution has slowed and that change is not occurring. And I'm not necessarily sure that was ever the case. We might have had some patterns of what we did on a day-to-day basis. You know, the whole sort of idea that we're not going to go to the office 5 days a week anymore. So we might have had some habits and some patterns that were, you know, operated at a, you know, important level personally, but in the grand scheme of things were relatively superficial. Mm-hmm. But really at the end of the day, you know, there was never a normal. There were just patterns with which we were familiar. And I don't think there will be any kind of normal, whether it's a new normal or a, you know, reset normal. Actually, if there's one hope out of all this, is that we have more of an appreciation of what change is and means and the opportunities that change can present to us, and that we stay innovative. You know, it would be a crying shame if all of the innovation and the fantastic creative thinking that's gone on suddenly at some point in the future subsides because we feel like we can just go back to a fairly routine pattern in our lives. You know, I'd like to think that this level of creativity could define the future rather than just be a momentary thing that's, you know, been driven by adversity.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, fingers crossed. I mean, the last part of the book is action. So this is where you present your 9 elements of change. I mean, I don't want to give too much away because I think everyone should go and get the book. But can you explain a bit about how this framework came together?
I use the periodic table in the last book because it seemed to resonate with people as a sort of very easy to, you know, it's a sort of, you know, it's a way of presenting information that we instinctively feel we understand, even though, you know, myself included, I don't really understand the chemical periodic table. But as a sort of structure, it's very useful as an aid memoir. And as I say, with the sort of being established in the first book. But, you know, this is really the sort of stuff that most material on change focuses on. It's the sort of stuff we do to make change actually happen and the sort of things we deploy when we lead change. But what I sort of built in the first part was the sort of foundation, the infrastructure of change, the understanding of change. Then in the second part was about being prepared for it. So, you know, if we understand change and we're prepared for it, we can do sort of, you know, we can do any of this stuff in part 3 in terms of the action that we take at any point whenever it needs to be done. And we're doing it on a sort of very firm basis. You know, this isn't, we're not just sort of chucking stuff at the wall, hoping some things work. We haven't just got a checklist of things. We know we've got a change project. We're going to do these 20 things and then everything's going to be fine. And we cross our fingers and hope. What it means is that when we actually take this action, we're taking it on a really firm grounding. You know, we do understand it. We are prepared. And so the things we do make sense. They make sense to us and everybody else around us and everybody that's involved. And using the periodic table sort of gives everybody the idea that to some degree or other, all of these things are going to be in the mix. You know, somewhere in the change initiative, each one of these 9 elements are going to be deployed. They're going to be part of the program. They may be dialed up in some instances, dialed down in others, but it's an entirely portable framework that can be used in, you know, in any discipline, any location for any kind of change initiative. And really helps with that detailed planning. You know, and just make sure that everything has been thought of, and that it's, you know, and it's on a built on a very firm foundation, and it's got a, you know, a huge chance of success.
I mean, can we say what the nine are?
Let's leave it as a surprise, shall we? Okay. Because I don't want sort of people say, well, that shouldn't be included. That should be included. When I did the 12 elements of a fantastic workplace, that was based on quite a lot of research, quite a lot of interaction. Usually starting with just sort of two whiteboards, just saying that these are the things that are really important, and these are the things that might be important to a number of people, but might not necessarily be important to everyone. And so, you know, that sort of process really was very useful in the first book. I didn't take that process with this book. I felt that sort of having, you know, having done a lot of research, a lot of reading about change and been involved in change for, you know, over 30 years of my professional career, that the same things kept cropping up, and the same things sort of were features of successful change initiatives. So I'm pretty confident they're the right nine elements. And each one of those is like opening a little door to another sort of universe, really, of practice and material and thinking. And what is fascinating in writing a book like this is just how many times you sort of stand on the edge of going off on a huge tangent. You think, gosh, you know, we're talking about, for instance, you know, sort of the way that we communicate. You know, there's a whole sort of industry of material out there, and practice and professional practice and those involved in helping people communicate. But you know, when you look at it over the space of a book, you've got a very small amount of space where you can try and draw out the key points and the salient issues and challenge some myths and look at some portable tools that you can actually pick up and start using today. But you really do have to maintain that structure throughout. You can't sort of have a lopsided approach that's got, you know, a huge section on communication and then you just reference the other things in passing. You have to keep that all in balance. So hopefully, again, you know, by presenting it in that sort of periodic table, it does say that each one of those nine elements is just as important as the other. With the first book, I kept being asked, you know, what are your top three? You know, everybody always wants to summarize it. If you've got a list of 12, what's your top three? I think if I had a list of three, people would say, what's the most important? Yeah, everybody exactly. Always wants a smaller number than the number you present. And I was always at pains to say, look, they're all as important as each other, depending on the context and the environment and the nature of the challenge you're facing. And so they will all have a part to play. And that's really about making sure that, you know, you consider each one in relation to what you're doing, and you think about it, and you always make sure that you're ready with the other elements as well, because you might not initially feel you need them, but they will touch on the initiative at some point during its life.
Sure, the magic formula. Okay, we'll leave it for people to find out. I mean, for anyone who's interested in knowing more from you and your work, where can they find you?
I'm working with a company called GoSpace AI, so you can find me there. And I'm on LinkedIn. I used to have a blog site, which I closed fairly recently. I felt like it was always sort of come to the end of its life, really, after about 10 years. I've started blogging through Medium, and I've been doing quite a lot of sort of, I'm quite enjoying the sort of the shorter form posts actually on LinkedIn itself. That's been quite interesting and got some good conversation going. I'm on Twitter, been on Twitter since probably sort of 2009, I think, as Work Essence. So you can find me there. And in all of my books, I put my email address, so I'm contactable. It's not too difficult to track me down. But, you know, one of the things the first book did, which I absolutely loved, was it created some fabulous connections and some great conversations. And you know, I'm fully expecting that a lot of people will disagree with what I've said in this book and will have their own views, because, you know, change is a much talked about subject. Far more than workplace when I published the first book, actually. That's very much in people's minds now, because of this sort of notion that potentially we, you know, for those people who work in offices, and that's only obviously a subset of the population, but not everybody might be going back on a day-to-day basis. And a lot of people are actually out of their offices at the moment. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's a huge amount of change material out there. Many people have views on what they will find in the book, so I'm looking forward to some you know, meeting some new people and having some good conversations as a result of it.
Yeah, absolutely. So do get in touch is the message then.
Yes, please.
Oh, thank you so much for joining us today, Neil. That was great.
Pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. And as I say, look forward to hearing what you think about the book.
Thank you so much to Neil Usher. And do remember, keep an eye on our social media at Lid Publishing, where we'll be sharing expert opinions, new books and podcasts with people such as Neil Usher. Take care, and we'll see you next time on Lid Radio Podcast.